Okay, thanks. So I spoke last week, so I felt I could be a little more free in what we talk about today. And the general thing I want to discuss, so as many of you know, I recently moved to Stony Brook to help start the so-called Science Center in Geometry and Physics, which is a research center really intended to, you know, has both mathematicians and physicists, and really intended to foster the interaction between them. And so I thought this might be a good opportunity to try to bring up questions which, you know, we've looked at these things a lot. There's a huge amount of structure and string theory in the problems we look at. You know, is there anything there, you know, of course we also talk to mathematicians a lot, but is there something there which either A, you know, hasn't been, you know, sufficiently explained to mathematicians and might be interesting and useful, or, you know, B, is really so central to us that we should emphasize this as, you know, really something to think about. And so I'm hoping to get some ideas from the audience and discuss that. I'm happy we now have a mathematician, at least one in the audience. Maybe I don't recognize others. So I thought that was a necessary condition. Now, having said that, of course, the topic is kind of hopelessly open-ended and vague because the breadth of what we talk about, and there are many kinds of mathematicians in many subfields. And the other thing which we could do this in either order is I'll try to talk about some of my own questions, trying to find some way of thinking about the landscape in more of a total way. And there's more kind of, you know, inspired by talking to various people, in particular Maxime Concevich. But, you know, it's something of, you know, related but perhaps independent interest. So let's see. So maybe I should start with a bit of that, since, you know, again, at least this is kind of pointing towards some mathematical questions or ways to think about things which are inspired by mathematics. So, what do we want? We want to know, you know, everything, presumably, or maybe just about one vacuum. But there are at least those two options. So we can ask these questions about single vacua. You know, so we have this primary question of reproducing the standard model and postulating all the structures that can do that in some vacuum. And of course, there's the kind of the opposite question of finding no-go theorems, that certain things aren't possible, and that you can understand this within the context of working in one vacuum. And then, you know, the landscape, you know, for purposes of this talk, what I'm going to mean is those questions that you really can't answer on the level of just thinking about one vacuum at a time. And so since we live in one or zero, you know, again, we may never have to think about this, but I certainly find it interesting, and it sheds light on
both ways. Sometimes you can't answer questions about single vacuum.
Exactly. I think the main hope here is that some questions here have much simpler answers, and then you can use that up there. Okay. So then the kind of questions you get there, of course, there's, you know, classification. So I put up the slide of the famous kind of Kreutzer-Skark shield diagram of the, you know, Hodge numbers of the toric hypersurfaces. And you know, is that really representative of the totality of Clavier threefolds? If it is, you know, what explains that structure, you know, either mathematically or physically? I haven't really heard any good explanations of it. So that's kind of a more idealized classification problem where you can, of course, work out all the details in principle, and then some sort of dramatic pattern or simplification suggests itself. And you're looking for that. We're trying to explain that. And then another kind of general question of this sort is dynamics. And this is something that we've really not, I think, begun to think about at all. Okay, so this is to say, again, you know, this is obviously either, you know, very early cosmology or very late time cosmology, which is generally completely untestable, but very early cosmology is testable either observationally or in terms of providing a measure factor. And again, to the extent we study dynamics, we tend to do that in the context of a single vacuum. And then, you know, there are very clear questions about reproducing cosmological data and trying to get your model to, you know, come out of what looks like some sensible initial condition. And then there's this, you know, larger question. Well, you know, presumably, you know, there is this, you know, landscape or configuration space containing all the vacuum and indeed all the configurations of interest to us. And we know that, you know, slow roll inflation, you know, moves you within some region of that landscape, and there could be more complicated dynamics, there could be quantum dynamics. And can we postulate, you know, obviously this is very, you know, very premature to really, you know, try to nail this problem down, and I think it's more at the exploratory point. You know, can we propose models that capture any of that? You know, can we kind of give any simplified model of the landscape which makes it somehow more concrete, and any kind of dynamics that at least look sort of like the real thing? And a lot of the work that I've seen in our field in this was under this category of time-dependent solutions, which was popular between 5 and 10 years ago. And that, to my mind, was a rather formally directed thing. You know, there were a few kind of physical questions that were raised, but you know, probably we need more questions. That was what I felt. And simple models to kind of illustrate phenomena and answers to questions.
So dynamics, you mean not just, you know, moving in a modelized space of a given complex?
Well, that's certainly
changing topology.
Oh yeah, definitely. Everything. Of course, if that ladder were impossible, that would be important to know. But we know that it's possible in certain cases. And the safe hypothesis at this point, of course, is that everything is connected until we get evidence otherwise. So right, that's the minimal question.
Yeah, was it changing number of dimensions?
Yeah, in principle, that could be interesting. That's right. And so that's right. That's certainly a minimal question, which things are connected by dynamics, and then one can be more detailed than that. Okay, so so we have this, you know, various levels on which we can work, and you know, again, this one, I certainly, my own, you know, a lot of my own work is when this, you know, vein of classification and then these idealized versions of that. And so an example of that is this work on, you know, flux vacua, where, you know, in principle, there is some, you know, huge discrete set of different quantized fluxes that stabilize moduli at certain places. And it's just obviously, you're never going to literally classify all of those. You know, there's too many, it's too intricate. And so you'd like some sort of simplified picture, like a distribution, which might not, you know, certainly not going to be exactly the answer, but at least they'll tell you there are more vacua here than there. You know, there's some lower bound on the number of vacua. You know, ideally we would have some upper bound and so forth. And so that's, again, you know, a level that you can work, and I've spoken about here in the past. And then there's this kind of other way you can try to work when, especially, you know, from the start, the problem is too complicated that you're ever going to, you know, you're never going to literally be able to classify things. And, you know, again, there are many results of this sort in mathematics. So if you talk about the structure of extra dimensions, that's certainly a shared problem of math and at least string physics, you know. And so already you get up to four dimensions, and you can prove you can never classify all the four-dimensional manifolds. And the argument is based on the fundamental group, that you can realize all possible fundamental groups, and you can show that there's just no way of classifying all groups. If you're given a presentation of a group, some generated relations, you can't even tell which one it is. It's an undecidable problem.
So is it possible that string theory doesn't classify things in that way? Is it topology can change, so the fundamental...
Oh, yeah, that's right. Certainly, the real questions that you're asking in string theory are not the same. So one optimistic scenario would be that all questions become simpler. in string theory. Okay, but I have a different. Let me just come right out and say what I think is the answer to that, which is that in making this kind of, you know, definition, you know, even defining what you mean by compactification, a very important point. So let's just, again, we'll talk about you know, extra-dimensional manifolds. So M, and then I'll then talk about, you know, stringy or other definitions of the same concept. It's in physical terms very important to put some lower bound on the KK scale, you know, or equivalently some upper bound on the diameter, which is the, you know, maximum distance between a pair of points. You know, intuitively, it's clear this is what's going to control the KK scale. You're going to get.
You could have a hidden CFT for all you care, right?
Right, that's right. I can say the same thing down here. In CFT terms, the basic equivalence would be that diameter is related to the inverse of the lowest operator dimension. We'll call that H1.
Well, sorry, what I'm saying is you can have something like a warped.
Yeah, that's right.
It goes forever. So you have to be a little careful about this definition, right? You could have Maslow's modes, in other words.
You could, in principle, that's right. You could in principle, make loopholes of the observable KK scale, shall we say. That's right. So there can be a loophole to this definition, but definitely observable KK scale is sufficiently vague that I'll hopefully cut this argument off. And my point wasn't so much the physical one as to say that, obviously, again, there's just this infinite, huge variety of manifolds. And you'd like to at least say, well, let's start with simple ones and go on to more complicated ones. And that's not so easy. But what is true is that as the diameter gets larger and larger, the things get more and more complicated. And so already having this cutoff gives you some sort of cutoff on the complexity of the problem, and is required in all the theorems that say anything like, you know, this set of manifolds is finite.
Mike, can I make a comment about the fundamental group issue?
Yeah.
So, you know, the theorem is that there isn't a good isomorphism classification of manifolds because of the fundamental group problem. But you could imagine a configuration space that had all manifolds in it.
Right. And I'm going there just to get to that.
Just didn't know how to do the two-step.
That's right.
Out by first isomorphism and then something else, so that you just have to deal with everything.
Yeah, good. That anticipates. That's right. This is, you're kind of anticipating my points, because again, my point was to say, even if you can't classify, there are still ways to think about it.
Right.
Exactly. So.
Another way of asking this question is just physically, what is it that you're trying to classify, given that all these things are ephemeral? I mean, in cosmology, right? If they are all connected, they're not. It's not really precise to.
Well, you're kind of feeding into my point here that we didn't even phrase the right question.
But I mean, yeah, what is it that
you're
trying to classify?
Well, again, you know, usually, one's usual picture of cosmology, I think, based on field theory, is that there's some big set of scalar fields, some big potential, and you can start kind of rolling around and tunneling on it. And, you know, in those terms, you'd like to say, well, there's this many fields at the most, and these components of that space, and so forth. And that's where the dynamics takes place. So you'd like some kind of description of the configuration space. Yeah. And then that over in this picture, that would include both choice of topology, moduli, you know, other things.
So what kind of comment? I mean, I think there are two things here. I mean, there's CFT, as you said, and there are these geometric large volume approaches classifying geometries. So from one point, I mean, if you turn around more and more fluxes, for instance, you cannot nicely describe this in CFT. So this is more like volume, finish one sector of the point. On the other hand, there are known CFTs where no large volume minimum exists, for instance, asymmetric volume fluids. So the space of CFTs is definitely richer than the space of large volume compactification.
Yeah, that's right. So that's right. So this is certainly an easier thing to ask the mathematicians about, and here it's at a much earlier stage, and we have all these very interesting phenomena. But certain, if you choose the right ideas from here, they all make sense down here. And I would say that the guiding principles, you know, again, if you look at the work that comes closest to giving you some overall map of, you know, the landscape of manifolds in the situation, those concepts ought to make sense down here. If the concept doesn't, that's very important to know. But I would try that first.
Because the problem with this classification of fundamental groups is that it's one of these undecidable propositions, is that right?
That's right.
So is it possible that the physics only asks decidable questions?
Well, already here, I think once you say this, you've made the problem decidable, because you can show there's only a finite number of topologies. And so undecidable problems, by definition, have to involve an infinite number of possibilities.
Mike, when you say there's a finite number of topologies, are you implying that there's some, let's say, Planck scale?
Yes, yes, I put, that's right. So a precise, yes. So let me quote a precise result of this sort, which there are varieties of. If you take basically every place, the curvature in every two-plane, and you say that that's less than, you know, between minus one and plus one, so that's the Planck scale, and you have to say that the volume in a manifold is greater or equal to some epsilon, and you say this. So definitely that's right. You have to put a scale in, and this is where we're putting the scale. And then there are versions of this theorem that make assumptions that look much more like the ones that are relevant to us. In particular, this can be weakened to non-negative Ricci. So that's certainly the things that you easily get out of, you know, the Einstein equation and string compactification. And so.
Sorry, what came?
Okay, so I'm saying that, you know, David's wrong. You can't just assume this. You could have tiny little handles, and so you have to put some sort of band on the curvature. And they're kind of naive, or, you know, this was very, you know, sophisticated when it was proposed. But just say every place the curvature never gets too big and too small. You know, say it's between minus one and one, and then you prevent these tiny little handles.
So but you can do that
on that. Right.
Right.
And then it turns out, you know, subsequent work, you don't need the upper bound. Okay, you can argue that just saying that it's say, you know, you don't need all the curvature. You just need the Ricci, say, to be non-negative.
That's a huge specialization, right?
I mean, well, yes and no. I that's right. We certainly. Yeah, there's a very important point, of course. You know, this I think I mentioned in my other talk, and I'm sure you've mentioned in your talks. So one of the basic principles here that you like to use to classify these manifolds is to somehow talk about positive curvature, zero curvature, and negative curvature. And then for two dimensions, that's very clear. You know, that's the sphere and the torus and everything else, genus.
That's why I was saying.
And so in that sense, you've thrown away almost everything.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, those are the ones that, you know, are very easy to use in string theory and come up all the time. And these ones are harder to use. And it would seem fair to say, on the evidence so far, these are probably more important than string theory, leaving aside the question of, you know, to what extent you
can use them. In which sense do you say the ones with r equals 0, for instance, are easier to use?
Okay, here's the basic observation. Again, it's wrong, it's oversimplified, but the basic observation is that we have to solve Einstein's equation, right? And this guy, for normal matter, is non-negative, the stress-energy tensor.
Yeah, but we have sources in string theory which don't behave like normal.
But only in very specialized ways. You can't have a totally general negative energy source, or else the theory will be completely unstable. It just produces these things everywhere. So okay. Definitely you need it to get the interesting solutions, but it's a tightly constrained thing. And of course, you know, I got a minus sign here too. I'm not saying that this argument proves it. We can get into, for example, you know, the paper I wrote with Renata or later things to try to come closer to this statement. But I would only say for the moment that, you know, on the evidence so far, you know, we know these guys come up a lot, and these guys are pretty hard to use.
Well, I think
that might be a false description of the true situation, but for one of the evidence so far. I think we'll certainly all agree on this. This is a key question, right? It's right. I mean, most of the, if we just list manifolds, most of them are like this, okay? If these are just as important in string theory as those, then we've hardly even scratched the surface.
Well, I would just say, from the point of view of phenomenology, there's all this evidence for supersymmetry that points toward either r equals 0 or r less than 0 in mild waves, things like reflexes and so on. So by the way, some of the R less than zero examples are equivalent to what you're calling article zero.
That's right. I was going to go on to make a better version of this. That's right. This was just this two-dimensional story.
Right. But if you are trying to ask from the top down without, if you, you know, weren't trying to use any of these hints and derive everything from the top down, it's really important to not just throw those away from the start. But I think,
well,
I think when it,
but it's important to know just what they can do for you. So again, another kind of you know, outcome could be that, well, you can use them, but they naturally lead to these time-dependent dynamical things. So they have an important role in early cosmology, and less so at the present era.
Well, I think that's true of almost every configuration. If you start with a manifold of R equals zero and add fluxes to it, then that
right. Yeah, that's right. So this is a particular case of that observation.
Yeah.
The only question I'm worrying about is this: when you try to, as you say, classify, count numbers, frequencies, if you want, even if the, imagine most of them were in the R smaller than zero remain.
Right.
Imagine that the constraint from the Einstein equations would, and the kind of specialized sources of non-normal matter, you are forced to use, throw away most of the negatively curved ones.
Right.
But if those are infinitely many.
That's right.
In only a finite fraction of it, they are.
I agree. Definitely, this deserves, you know, this point must be understood better than we understand it now. That's right. So okay, well you can see we got into a area of current discussion, shall we say, and then there are, but and again, my point was to say that, you know, this is kind of a basic classification which you would like to think there's some version of this in string theory, you know, in conformal field theory, in string theory. There's much more sophisticated versions of this. Of course, once you go to even three dimensions, you know, it's not obvious, you know, that things break up in this simple way. And there are other ways you can try to phrase the classification. One that Eva was sort of alluding to is that you can look at the pi 1 in the manifold. Okay, so here it was, of course, trivial, you could look at quotients of the sphere and get something finite. You know, here you got z to the dimension for this torus, and then here you have these big hyperbolic groups, whereas you know, add more and more, you move on more and more generators, you just get this exponentially growing number. And then that's a correct, that's certainly a trichotomy of the set of fundamental groups, which is another good guide to what's going on here. And so things which have a tiny negative curvature can actually sit in this class, like the nil manifold. Okay, so.
And these are connected. Yeah, I think we have evidence that there are topology-changing transitions that go from.
Oh yeah, that's right. So definitely there are topology. Well, you want to talk about like t-dualities and things.
Well,
and then there are also transitions. That's right. There are both things. That's right.
Yeah.
And so that's right. That starts to bring you down in the air. Okay, so anyways. Three dimensions, you know, people just made this kind of, you know, major progress, and then beyond that, the problem is pretty hard to work on. And so we could ask, well, you know, how do the mathematicians work on it? And we could ask, well, nevertheless, you know, even if we can't, you know, classify, you know, the four manifolds or the six manifolds, is there some sort of a structure that we can put them all in to at least help us think about it? And the simplest answer to that question is, well, yeah, there's a very standard thing you can do, which is you can try to embed all the manifolds in some common higher dimensional space. And so the simplest choice would be Euclidean n-dimensional space. And of course, you know, it's clear you can you know, embed all these guys in three dimensions. Once you start talking about non-orientable things in two, you have to go up to four dimensions, right? And and then the Rn, you know, the n you need grows with the dimension, okay? But that's kind of a topological or a differential topological statement. You just embed the manifold. Okay, and then there's this much more interesting version of it, which I think has some relevance to physics, which is, can you embed a manifold? Okay, but anyway, let me just, you know, before I move into that, what's the picture? It's this very naive one. Well, you know, it's certainly true. I can get them all to sit in the same space, and I can think about them all on the same footing. Right? Yeah. So very, very naive, but at least it does suggest, you know, dynamics that lets you, you know, shrink cycles and move and change one of these into another one. And that is a correct picture. You know, that's certainly something you can do, whether or not you can classify the manifolds. And okay, so it's proven that you need twice the dimension as the Whitney and Benning theorem, but that's a very weak kind of thing. You know, it's just this topological statement that we know that we need the metric and so forth. So what's sort of more interesting? You know, there are more interesting theorems in this direction, and another famous one is the Nash and Benning theorem. Right down here, because I'll just write the point. So this is talking about isometric embedding, meaning that given we start with the flat metric, the Euclidean and dimensional space, we induce a metric on this embedded surface. It's just to say we have some map xi, you know, which is the explicit map, you know, from the original manifold into the space, so I runs from 1 to n. And now we have the pullback metric, which is just, you know, dxi, dxj, delta ij, the flat metric up here, and then alpha beta. So just what you would use in writing, you know, the membrane action. And so now the question is there an embedding? Is there some way of choosing the x's so that you know, whatever metric you want, you could get it this way? And then, so that would be a much stronger statement because, you know, that's certainly the kind of data you would want. So we think about it as a string theory, supergravity solution or whatever. You know, you could go on to ask, maybe I can postulate a B field, I can postulate Riemann-Riemann fields and so forth, and I could try to get them all that way, you know, by pulling back the universally, you know, chosen higher dimensional field. And sorry, you know, constant B field, constant C field, and so forth. And the answer, you know, this was proven by Nash, is one of the things that made him famous in the 50s, is that you can do it, and there is a definite N you need. And what's the naive N? Okay, well, the naive N is to say, well, how many components does the metric have? It has d plus 1 over 2. So we have to have that many functions on M that we're trying to tune. So if we had that many functions here, you know, as many functions as there are constraints. And so that's certainly necessary. But of course, you know, then it's not all obvious. It, you know, the thing is, it has to bend around in a very specifically chosen way. And so you won't be surprised that it's, you know, the actual N is bigger than this. But it's not much bigger. It's like D plus 3 over 2 or something. Not that much bigger than that. It certainly grows as this d squared over 2. So it's not a very constrained problem. You know, you can put all the manifolds isometrically into this common higher dimensional space. And
are there any theorems like that for Lorentz signature? I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't seen it. That's a good question.
Because the dichotomy into Riemannian and yeah, separate.
Yeah.
Space-time is maybe another sort of assumption at the beginning.
Yeah, definitely, that's right. I'm oversimplifying the whole, the total situation. Of course, time is different, you know, so you could work in a Hamiltonian canonical framework and avoid that question, but it's an interesting question, yeah. And also the theorems that talk about this. I mean, there is this general approach to these things, but that's, you know. So my point being that, well, yeah, again, you can fit all the manifolds you're interested in some common higher dimensional space and at least get this intuitive picture about how they could, you know, dynamically change one into the other. And then, of course, this kind of description is not only mathematically nice, but we know physically, at least just in string theory, that this is nice as well, because what are we doing? We're basically saying, well, of course, if you want to make a sigma model version of this construction, you're not allowed to just say, well, you know, my fields just, you know, map into this submanifold X. Rather, what you're going to do is you're going to postulate some potential function of the X's so that the minima of the potential satisfy this equation and divide the manifold M. And once you do that, you have exactly the linear sigma model. And of course, it's you know, very clear. Linear sigma model is a very good way to think about these problems and see how different kinds of manifolds can have topological transitions and the like. So That's certainly another reason to think this is not a random thing to study.
For the linearity of a single molecule is the statement of this isometricness?
It's this. It's the statement that we started with the flat metric. Yeah. Okay, so a survey paper, I'm finishing on some of these things, I threw out the bold conjecture with not much any more evidence than this, that for a given C, okay, so now we're trying to make a conjecture about this, maybe you can realize every conformal field theory of that C as some sort of linear sigma model with n of fields that goes only like C squared. And it might be like 2C squared or something, but in some order one thing times C squared. And again, that's kind of a guess at that point, but I think, again, it's quite reasonable to think there should be universal descriptions that contain all the CFDs up to a given central charge, if we, if we can find them. Okay, so so that's at least starting, again, to, ideas for how one could think about the totality of the landscape in a slightly more concrete way. Now, what about this dynamics? Okay, so that's, again, a hard problem. I think even in the supergravity limit, I've started to feel it's, I can safely say it's not well understood by me. But, again, it's not, people don't know everything they could know. And so, there's complicated equations to solve, and you obviously can't do it. But one version of this, which I've been, I'm trying to think about, is this slow roll inflation version to say, not the general dynamics, but what are the situations where the observable, space-time in four dimensions is expanding exponentially, and by the standard argument we use in cosmology, we have equations of motion through the scalar fields, which in four dimensions will look like this. I. So that's an equation of motion, and of course, if the expansion is large, we can neglect that term and get some sort of gradient flow down this potential hill, and eventually it flows down and reads and oscillates and eventually settles down. But we're just going to ask about this part of the process, and what can one say in general terms about that? And so the kind of starting point for my thinking was that what's a natural flow equation that talks, not about scalar fields, but about the metric and the other information that we would need to describe an actual supergravity solution. And of course, there is a very natural flow equation, which is that we take the metric and we take d by dt to be minus the Fritchie tensor. And of course, that's a famous one that I guess we can in some sense take credit for, because Stanford Ann wrote this down as the beta function equation in two-dimensional sigma models. So we certainly have thought about that, and we know it has some interest. And it could also, in principle, be a kind of general model of slow roll inflation. Okay, so now why would you say that? Okay, well, there's this argument, which is that what's the V? Okay, the V is some functional of metrics, and we just vary the V with respect to GIJ, and if we can just get this, then we're all set. Okay, so what can the V be? Well, there really aren't very many options. It has to either be this or this. And it's clear from the Einstein, high-dimensional Einstein equation is this. And then you can vary this, and then you get something kind of like this, but it's not this, of course. It's the same old Einstein tensor. So it's close, and you might take that as kind of good enough place to start. If you start to worry about this term, then you realize that this doesn't work at all, and the equation with this term isn't a good flow equation. And rather than go into the mathematics of that, it's simply the point that I was making in my talk last week, that the conformal factor of the metric is different from all the rest, and leads to this negative sine kinetic term. So every fluctuation of the conformal factor is tachyonic, and now you're trying to make a flow, and you have tachyons of arbitrarily negative m squared. So obviously, it's a very badly behaved flow. So you have to do something about that. And again, kind of the simplest thing you can try to do is take the sort of potential that I described in my talk and try to vary that. And then you don't get the right thing either. Okay. And the flaw with that, of course, is that in writing the thing I wrote before, I was a bit naive. I left out the fact that there's an actual kinetic term under space of metrics, and you have to know it to write this flow. And in fact, by using the freedom, you know, of course, if you write this down, there are two terms under space of metrics, delta g, delta g, and you can subtract the indices in two ways. By using that freedom, you can actually also subtract that unwanted term. Okay, and then if you derive this from, you know, again, higher dimensional Einstein equations, that's what you get. It's this mechanism that subtracts it. So the problem is not so much in the potential, the problem's with the kinetic term. Okay, so that is, again, not the full, you know, there's just, you know, many more subtleties, but at least, you know, it's correct. There is some regime where the flow looks kind of like this. And,
you already erased the Feitel-Lalonde term, which is assuming you get a slow roll regime.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be a self-consistent. That's right. I'm just trying to be self-consistent.
No, you just said there's a regime like this, but we don't get that because.
Well, I'm certainly not going to derive it at all. I mean, this has to do with the space-time thing. I mean, you would presumably find your solution and then, you know, self-consistently justify it in the full Einstein equation.
I'm just saying you're looking for already
Well, yeah. So, I mean, again, I haven't gotten all the way, but you would. How do you ever justify this? You know, you drop that term, you find a solution, you plug it back in, and check that that term is small in the regime that is interest. Right.
Sure. I'm just saying it shouldn't be falling out of Einstein's equation. No, generality.
Well, no. It's just a class of solutions that you can check. It's by no means the full, you know, set of possibilities. I'm just making a fairly weak statement that, you know, if I put very strong conditions, maybe I sit right up near the top of the hill, I will be able to get this term to be small.
So it's a question whether that is possible with purely curvature, is what I'm saying. You have a potential that's coming only from the geometry of some compactification.
You're worried about the question of whether I can stabilize the volume of the extra dimensions.
Yeah, well, I'm worried about whether the slow roll condition should ever be satisfied just curvature alone, and no other.
It can certainly be satisfied for a tiny amount of time. You know, if you want 50 E foldings, that's a different question. But you can certainly satisfy it for some short time.
Well, the slow roll conditions are. The second one is the one that addresses that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, like, again, you know. Locally, you know, you can control that parameter, and it has to stay small along the trajectory for some time. That's a harder question.
Well, that's the question of erasing the Feitel-Lalonde, actually. Right?
Well, again, if I really just follow the time evolution for some time epsilon, right, then I just compute this at that time. Right? I mean, that's the physics question, definitely you have to control it for a certain amount of time. So. But anyways, you know, again, I haven't gotten to the point of trying to do any physics with this. And again, there is this at least very limited regime where you can think about the problem. You know, you can think about this as a subset of the bigger problem. And so you can ask, you know, again, this is certainly something you can ask mathematicians about, especially where I work, where John Morgan is the director, who just wrote a long book about Ricci flow, trying to explain Perelman's proof. And so what can you learn? You know, what can you have mathematicians?
What is phi here?
Okay, phi is to say that we would, you know, how would you think about this in four-dimensional terms? You would, you know, find all the, you know, some class of metrics. All their moduli. You would agree that, you know, every module is a phi.
Okay, so
but
phi is
then there are KK modes, and then the KK modes are also phis. Of course, they might be very massive, so you might not need to keep them, but in principle, they're there. And so the point is that these are all the scalar fields, and by not doing the mode expansion and just keeping them all, we can think of this, the metric on the internal space, as a generating function summarizing a whole set of phis. So that's the basic analogy.
I'm still confused. The satisfying this flow equation, is that enough to guarantee that the operator of the space-time equation for a phi is satisfied not only for an infinite hesitant neighborhood in time, but for some finite time interval?
Well, I think the only thing that's easy to see is that the slower you roll, the easier it becomes to show it. But again, I wouldn't even claim you could, it would be obvious that you get even one e-folding this way. You would have to go back. But again, the way you would study that is not some mysterious thing. You find the trial solution and you plug it back in and see if it satisfies the condition. So, on that level, I don't see how you can argue with this. I mean, it might be that the interesting physics, well, again, this is especially once I start adding fluxes. Okay, so there's an obvious generalization of this. We put in the fluxes, and then you just say d by dt of d of like b or c as dv, and so forth. Right. And this is a pretty general class of models.
You probably need your n-fold or something to get it all to work.
You might be right. We'll find out.
If you can generalize to that case also, I assume.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm not wedded to supergravity, and one can now certainly put in some sort of streamy sources and that rule surrounding A, and again, I'm more trying to get some description that will cover a large swing of the space and see if there are any general things one can try to say. And so what do mathematicians know about this? And they know a huge amount in three dimensions thanks to Perelman, and they don't know a whole lot in higher dimensions. But what they do know something about is the Kähler-Ricci flow. Okay, so what's the Kähler-Ricci flow? That's where you just say that this is a Kähler metric. Okay, but then you have to prove, of course, that this flow respects the condition that this is a Kähler metric. Okay, so what is it? Basically, you can think you choose a complex structure, and then this is this 1-1 form, and the Kähler form is closed. And then in that situation, the Ricci tensor is 1-1, so it's not going to change the complex structure. It looks like it's going to, it's certainly going to change the Kähler form into another 1-1 form, and then you can check, it's closed, So the Ricci flow keeps you within the class of Kähler metrics.
So by the way, there's another place you can look for a place where there's a flow equation, which is to get friction from some other scalar field. So if you pick out two scalar fields here, and one of them rolls down a steep potential, and it couples to others, that leads to friction for the others, so you can get an
interaction
like this.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's interesting too.
So, that might be easier to get that classically.
It might be, and there might be some sort of geometrization of that too, some big class of things that behave that way. So anyways, what do people know about the Kähler-Ricci flow? And this is apparently a long and growing story. We're going to have a workshop about this next winter, so I can advertise it now. And the main thing you would like to, the thing you would like to argue, okay, so what was the basic conclusion of, the conclusion of Perelman's work was that in three dimensions, okay, well, let's just say it in two. Okay, how can you understand this classification in two? Well, there are these constant curvature metrics. And there's an easy way to find out where your manifold belongs. Find the constant curvature metric and read off the curvature. And then if you can integrate it over the manifold, you can even compute the genus in two dimensions. And so then the claim, which was proven, much before, probably by Hamilton, is that this equation, starting from you know, very wide, you know, from our point of view, any metric, obviously there are conditions, but any metric in one of these two-dimensional surfaces will flow to one of these constant curvature metrics. So the point being that all the KK modes in physics language are massive, and so they flow down to zero faster than the volume modulus. Of course, if it's curved, right, only for the zero Ricci de torus will that be an actual fixed point solution. And for the other cases, what's going to happen is we're going to asymptote to a scaling solution where the Rij is just constant. And then, you know, two things can happen, right? So either Rij, where the Rij is, you know, either proportional to plus or minus the Rij. And mathematically, now you just say, you know, I'm going to, add or subtract that term here, and you know, get a fixed point in that sense, you know, so normalized Kähler Ricci flow. And physically, what you would, of course, say is that these are very different. You know, so in this case, the manifold blows up and never stops blowing up. And in this case, it shrinks down to zero, and some sort of non-perturbative physics has to take over. But in any case,
can I just mention that in regard to this dichotomy, that sort of hardest technical part in that result of Hamilton's, which he anticipated being really easy to prove but wasn't, was the case where the initial condition has mixed sign of the Ricci curvature. Some regions of the manifold positive,
yeah,
some regions negative. And to show that the Ricci curvature sort of excised the region of wrong curvature and eventually settled down to something of the correct curvature.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Well, from what I said.
That did happen. And that's pretty interesting if you think about, initial conditions in the universe or whatever configuration space of possible initial conditions you might have. That trichotomy is probably only valid locally, right? You would expect this region to have positive curvature, that region to have negative curvature.
Well, we don't know. So the result you just quoted, and of course the result in three dimensions.
Well, I said that at the evolution, it would be constant sign, but not the initial conditions.
Well,
exactly.
So perturbations tend to dilute as a
space. Well, no, see, the issue. The issue is what we just said. So if there's a big minus region, that minus region will expand.
It's the expanding part that dominates.
Yeah, that's right. So you even if you have started with a sphere, you might have worried that the minus region will just keep expanding and stay there forever. And I think what you've just said is that the limited evidence to hand says that everything will settle down, regardless of initial conditions. All we really know is two and three dimensions.
Right.
People probably have seen the results.
In three dimensions, of course,
there
can be topological.
It's much more interesting because you get these junctions. Okay, so the three-dimensional story deserves a talk on its own because the essential thing is that although there are eight types which refine this trichotomy, you don't flow down to one of the eight types. What you kind of do is break the manifold into pieces that have junctions between local sections, which each have one of the eight types. So it's already very sophisticated, and of course four is research and not known. But this Kähler case is getting much better under control, and so this was to say that what's the hope? The hope is that by flowing, doing the Ricci flow, whatever you start with on your manifold, you'll wind up with some canonical metric, and you just can read off things, say, about the topology from the properties of that metric. Or you can break it apart into pieces that are easier to analyze, which is what happened in the three. And people, especially Tian, I think, have made a good deal of progress in understanding that. And again, it's probably, at this point, I could give you kind of a scattered overview of that, but maybe since I said I would kind of open things up to other possible mathematical questions, let me say that I've explained a question I'm asking mathematicians about, and it would be interesting to hear other kind of preoccupations of people. Here's something which either I am talking about with mathematicians, or it could be interesting. So let me stop there for now and open the floor to that kind of discussion.
Well, sorry, can I ask you one question about this idea? So you flow toward just natural metrics on any given space is the idea.
Yeah.
So is there any argument that the modes that flow away, so to speak, as you approach that metric are they heavier? Are they sort of?
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. There, it's the you know, exactly this KK, which you do the mode expansion. You have the kinetic term, the spatial part of the kinetic term.
So in some sense, it's determining for you what the moduli are. Of course, that's
right. In principle, you could think of integrating out the heavy ones and getting lighter ones. But then, of course, locality is not manifest, and you know, it's very valuable to keep the locality around.
Well,
but of course,
if we tried to compactify in general space, you might ask, what are the most sort of urgent instabilities that you want to stabilize?
Tachyon.
This is a procedure for
finding them in principle. That's right. That's right. This will immediately show up tachyons. Yes. Well, let's see. I mean, I did too good a job here because people probably don't want to. So.
I have a question. Could you use that kind of flow technology to study a question like deciding between, if you have these flows and some of them describe something that looks like inflation, let's say.
Yeah.
To discriminate between like inflationary flows that move geometrically long distance,
right,
and geometrically small distance.
Yes, definitely. I mean, we know the distance. In this problem, there's a metric on the space of metrics, and that's the distance. And that does show up explicitly in work like purposes. You're very key to define these distances.
You could hope to make it in principle a discrimination between how often you get flows that move.
Definitely,
long
that's
distance.
Right. It's not at all crazy to think that someday, one consider a huge class of initial conditions in six dimensions and say that yes, the vast majority never had inflation, or some distraction in some sense.
Well, the vast majority only moves smallish.
That's right. Large field. That's right. It's certainly far beyond what we can do now, but it's a problem you could formalize even at this point. Even if
so you would get in the end, could hope to get an answer as long as you don't take infinite flows into account, like flows that never finish.
Well, it's interesting to know if those exist too. I mean,
but if you model that question, you only consider finite flows. You could then hope to get an answer for whether small distance flows are better.
You could hope, yeah. Okay, let's see. Okay, well, I mean, I'm not sure what time it is, so I can stop at this point if people. Or I can keep answering questions about this. This is just kind of one, in fact, more speculative kind of question of this type that you could push on. People may well have other ideas about what are the central problems that we face. I mean, the main thing, of course, you can confirm or deny this. It tends to be very hard to convince mathematicians to focus on the intricacies of something as complicated as the Stieder model. And Dave is one of the rare exceptions. And so one typically does have to somehow broaden the question or focus on what seems like a crucial point of the question.
Well, if you want to treat a mathematician as a consultant, you have to state a precise mathematical problem.
That helps.
And most of the time, you'll be told that it can't be solved.
But that's in the short time scale. See, I mean, I think there's the much more kind of entertaining story, where the guy, the physicist, comes and presents his problem, some equations and some expert PDE. Of course, this. You live this story. And, finally he explains the problem, and the mathematician says, I don't know how to solve that, but it's kind of interesting, and I'll think about it. And then 2 years later, he comes back to the guy's office, and the physicist is still there. And he says, I solved your problem. He starts writing on the board. And the physicist says, what problem? So it's also good to pick one which is known to have some sort of lasting significance. And then on that time scale, you get more fruitful interaction.
The string theory helps mathematicians also in this more general arena of geometries that go beyond Calabi-Yau's. So one thing that actually Dave and I have discussed is this virtual Perfetti number conjecture, for example.
Right.
There are conjectures about the topology of these spaces that seem like they might be informed by string theory.
That's my phone, but we're going to finish soon. I'll get it done. I thought I was going to. Maybe so. It's dead.
That doesn't miss the answer to your problem.
Could be 42.
So what kind of no? I mean, not to mention coming back to something what you mentioned earlier. Right. So these no-go things. I think. What else do you have in mind? I mean, also like, I could imagine that you have classes on a string like that. Is a no there? You know, like certain. This might not be general. All this is making no-go theory.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
You have in mind things like this?
Well, in principle, yeah. Certainly not any specific thing. I mean, definitely. I'm sure. Yeah, I certainly hope, and I'm pretty confident that the vast majority of things are not possible. And again, I suspect you would have to, at this point in time, be more fruitful to idealize the question, you know, and ask something like, you know, if you have, you know, these traditional cubic tensor of Yukawa couplers, instead of, you know, asking, you know, about the details, just say, well, let's just, you know, look at something like this, you know, we add them all up, you know, using the metric, you know, the Kermitian ties, you know, does this thing have an upper bound? You know, who knows, you know, so that one might get an answer to, you know, mass at the top core, I wouldn't try at this point.
Which one also is getting into T5?
Yeah,
T5
definitely, yeah.
So, I mean, another one of the challenges, which is related to my previous comment, is, I mean, a question like that, so you're giving some kind of semi-classical formulation of a question, and then, or large volume or something of that sort, and then the mathematician 2 years later might come back with an answer, but it could be that you've improved your non-perturbative understanding of things in the meantime, so that you realize that that answer does improve a number of things.
But within a class, and I think, you know, even, you know, 10 years ago, certainly 20 years ago, this kind of thing would be premature. You know, we kind of, there were too many, you know, unexplored, you know, directions. And now you can at least entertain the hypothesis that, you know, for certain areas of the theory, we kind of know the possibility. And so this is certainly a question that we could have stated both here and in conformal field theory. And the answer here really is very relevant to the answer here, right? If you talk about B models, it's the same answer. It's between the zero, so. Yeah. That's right, you should keep that in mind in asking the question, but we can start to ask questions where we have some reason to think the answer is a lasting value.
What's the status of G2 in France for the mathematician? Constructing compact G2 manifolds. Is there anybody, I mean, is there any progress or is it?
Well, so, I mean, there are two construction techniques that now exist. Neither of them produces a lot of information about that manifold that was constructed. And so I'm not quite sure what I mean by a lot of information, but I contrast it with the case of Galabiel n-folds, where thanks to Yau's theorem, we just kind of plug into the whole topic of algebraic geometry, and then we have a way of describing many gross features of the Galabiel manifold, even if we don't know the local details of the metric, which we certainly don't. In the case of G2 manifolds, I mean, there's the original Joyce construction of modifying an orbifold to get a compact G2 manifold. There's a more recent construction, and my brain is blanking out the name.
Carvalho.
Thank you. Where you start with a sort of degenerate G2 manifold that looks like it was built out of some Calabi-Yau threefolds, and you construct some metric on this smoothing of this sort of degenerate Calabi-Yau threefold. So I think you can compute Betti numbers in all cases. You could probably compute trilinear couplings, mm-hmm. but that's probably the limit of what you can compute.
In all those cases, it's essentially singularity-free work. To all and those cases, work is singularity-free.
Right. And another
physics comes from the singularities.
Right. Another important thing to notice is that the very beautiful constructions of G2 metrics on singular spaces looks at least. At the moment, as if it doesn't immediately plug into these constructions that are compact. So there seems to be more rigidity about the structure at infinity on those Cohomogeneity 1 metric constructions than there would have been for similar constructions of Ricci 5 metrics in the neighborhood of singularities on Calabi-Yau spaces. Mm-hmm. So again, one can hope that eventually there would be some theory in which you would understand the limits in the moduli space, which would include singularities, or how to modify the constructions to include singularities. But this is really in its infancy. I mean, Gordy, you've probably read as much of the literature as I have. I mean, have I missed something? I think
it's easy. There's two or three
papers. Not the design literature.
What about examples that are dual to the heterotic stream? Say you have, on the heterotic side, you have a Calabi-Yau, which is D3 fiber.
Right. So the first, I would say, modern piece of mathematical work on G2 manifolds was this theorem of McLean, who was a student of Robert Bryant, and by the way, who's just completely mistimed his career in mathematics, because it's only when he stopped being able to get jobs that his result became relevant to people and got picked up. That's okay. He's a surgeon now. He's quite happy that everything worked out fine. But McLean's original hope in his thesis was to make this kind of construction, was to take a family of K3s, a three-parameter family of K3s, and compactify appropriately. And it's the compactify appropriately which is so hard. So figuring out, what kinds of three-parameter families of K3 metrics might assemble themselves into a reasonable G2 space is not so bad. But we don't have a good local picture of what kind of degenerate K3s you would need to fill in that fence. So let me contrast that with the SYZ construction, where by now, having thought about it for 10 or 12 years, 15 I guess, people have some notion of what you're supposed to fill in. But in the K3 case, to build G2 manifolds, so far as I know, there isn't a really good idea of what you're supposed to use to fill in. So he settled for his good theorem. I mean, that was sort of the fallback position.
More comments?
Is there an upper bound on the range of beach groups in, say, FPV? Or?
Is there an upper bound on the ranks of beach groups in F3 in four dimensions?
Yeah.
Well, many of us believe that the number of diffeomorphism types of Calabi-Yau manifold of fixed dimension will be finite. And if that's true, then there's an upper bound.
Why do you believe them? Or why do many people
believe? I'm not sure they have really good reasons for believing it, but
there's just no infinite family. There's no, I don't think there's any stronger reason.
Nobody knows an infinite family.
Yeah.
Not only does nobody know an infinite family, but you can explain why there are infinite families of K3s, of algebraic K3s, and not infinite families of higher dimensional Calabi-Yau. And the explanation might go like this. So if you look at the Riemann surface, which is a linear section of a projective Calabi-Yau, then for K3, that's a Riemann surface that's embedded by its conical bundle. So all you have to have is any Riemann surface, and you can sort of embed that way. Now that's a little misleading, because not every Riemann surface can actually be put on K3, but anyway, it doesn't get that there's nothing that special about the Riemann surfaces that live as hyperplane sections of K3s. But if you go to Calabi-Yau threefold, it's now got to be a Riemann surface with a half conical bundle. If you go to Calabi-Yau fourfold, it's got to be a Riemann surface with a third conical bundle. So it gets more and more special, the types of Riemann surfaces that you're allowed. And not only are the Riemann surfaces special, but they now need large families of them to assemble, sort of fit together to be all the hyperplane sections of different dimensions of this empty space. So that's just one kind of sense of why life might be hard.
Another kind of philosophical question, maybe. Do you think that having a microscopic formulation of M-theory would be helpful in understanding understanding income quantification, or do you think that these are completely decoupled?
No, no, certainly it would shed a lot of conceptual light on things to have a real microscopic formulation, but you can't predict just how it would help, but it always helps.
That would be another workshop.
Yes, could you?
Yes. And what's the status of that question right now?
It's stable.
Okay, then thank you again.